fortunate tonight to be have our speaker here, June C. She's come to us all the way from Mounds, Oklahoma. She's been in the Al-Anon program for 8 years. She has her husband at home and she's the parents of three grown adult children who are in the AA program. She's been really active in service work in Al-Anon in Oklahoma. She has chaired the state Al-Anon conference. She's been on the planning committee for 3 years, has done a lot of group level work, and is very, very active in service work. She finds that the 12 steps work in all the areas of her life, not just with her recovering alcoholics. So we're really fortunate. I can't wait to hear her story. When I picked her up at the airport yesterday, she told me how she had 50 minutes to change planes in Atlanta and found out she had a 2-mile hike to make. And somehow she got someone with a wheelchair to push her 2 miles. June?
Hi, everyone. My name's June. And I am from Mounds, Oklahoma. And Mounds, Oklahoma is just right down the road from Tulsa, just about 20 minutes south of Tulsa. And that's where I go to group, is in Tulsa. That's my home group. And she's right about the... Boy, I tell you, I didn't think I was going to make it. And I asked them if I could ride that little shuttle, and they said no, they weren't going that way. And I thought, I can't get there on time. And so there was a kid standing there with a wheelchair, and I got in. It pays to be old. It was a nice ride, too, and it was a long ways. And I did ask them, and they said they thought it was 2 miles. Well, I never would have made it. But anyway, I'm just real happy and real thrilled to be here. You all just don't know what kind of a thrill this weekend is for me. And I want to thank Bonnie for picking me up at the airport. And I want to thank Debbie for asking me to come. And I want to thank all of you who have participated in any way for this weekend. The food is wonderful. The lodge is lovely. And I don't know, there's just not anything in Oklahoma to compare with the beauty of these mountains. I spent a good bit of time today alone, just walking around, made tears come to my eyes. If someone should have told me in 1987, when I walked into the first meeting of Al-Anon, heartbroken, lonely, frustrated, angry, and all those things, that if I should stay, someday God would allow me to come to a place such as this, I would have not thought it was possible. So it's truly by the grace of God that I'm in this program, and it's truly one of God's blessings that he allowed me to come here and spend some time with you all this weekend. I very much enjoyed listening to Liz last night. And as I sat there on the front row and listened to her story of recovery and looked at her, I was trying real hard to get a mental image of this lovely, quiet young lady streaking buck naked. Across a college campus, and I never got it. I just couldn't. I tell you, it just blew my mind. I know we're in for a real treat tomorrow evening to hear Maggie's story of recovery. I got to go to one of the seminars today on dreams, and the lady that led that was just absolutely a joy and a delight, and I so much enjoyed all of it. I like to start my story by saying that I suffer from a disease called alcoholism, and I don't drink. Alcoholism invaded my home subtly. It came in so quietly, so surely, and it devastated a family of people that loved each other so very, very much. that it bankrupt us in every area. Each of us so sick in our own way, and none of us could see. I was raised in a small farming community just south of Tulsa. I'm a farm girl, and I'm real proud of my heritage. My daddy was very successful in his business. I have one sister, 6 years younger than me, that is my dearest friend and always has been. I had a lovely, lovely home. I had a beautiful mama. They stayed home and did the things mamas do. She cooked great meals. She took good care of her children. And my daddy was the kind of man that was handsome. And we had all the financial security that we needed. We had all the things we needed and most of the things we wanted growing up in that home. There was no alcohol in that home. There was no cussing. There was no violence of any type in my home. It was just a beautiful, lovely home. And when I was 17 years old, I met and married a young man that lived right down the road from us, who also came from a family of people that were well known in that community. Like my family, they'd been there forever. They were prominent people in that community for different reasons than mine was. These people had one of their members of their family was in McAllister, Oklahoma Penitentiary, that's state penitentiary in Oklahoma, for shooting his daddy on Christmas Day and killing him. They made whiskey out in their backyard. They had whiskey still. They ran that whiskey up and down the road. They were always running from the law. Their mama cussed like a sailor. She smoked one cigarette after another. They had beer in their refrigerator. There wasn't a Bible to be found in that house. You never, ever had to go to church. I was brought up going to church 3 times a week, all the time, in the church house. We never had to do any of those things, and I could not wait to marry into that family and get... And move out there on that hill and become one of them. And I did that, and it absolutely, like, buried my precious little mama and my daddy. They were devastated, and they promised me so many things if I wouldn't do it, but I went right ahead and did that anyway. And so I moved out on that hill with that family of people, and I did all the things that we do when your husband starts drinking. My husband, after I'd been married to him for 3 months, he began to drink. His mom allowed us how it was my fault. And they told me it was my fault, so I said, must be something I'm doing wrong. So I began to do all the things that we do when we try to keep up. I tried honky-tonking with him. I tried staying home. I tried keeping the house better. I tried looking better. I tried everything I knew how to do. And I was not able, ever, to stop him from drinking. He became a violent and a vicious drunk. And many, many times, I took beatings at his hand. And the sad part about that story is I never had to live like that. My family was 10 miles down the road, financially able to take me, and I had 3 children as a product of that marriage, always able and more than willing to take me and those children home, and I would not go. I lived like that for 9 years. And finally, one day, my daddy came to me, and he said that he would rent me a house right across the field from where he lived on some of his land, some land that he rented, and my children and me could move down there. And so on Monday morning, he came with a truck. He sent his field hands with a truck, and they moved me and those babies back home. And I was 25 years old, and I allowed his how that my life was over. I didn't think there would be any way in the world that anybody would ever come along and want me and 3 little snot-nosed kids. And my daddy was the old-fashioned kind. You know, he didn't believe in women working. And I had no skills. I had not gone to college. I had finished high school. But I had no skills, no way of making a living. And so my daddy came to me and he told me that he would keep us up, and he did this gladly. And he never made me feel that I was taking something that wasn't mine. It was okay. He had such a generous heart. And so he said, I will give you a job, and your job will be you stay home and take care of my grandchildren. And so that's what I did. 18 months later, I met and married within 3 months the man I live with today. And that was 35 years ago. This man came into my life quite by accident. And he had two little girls, and I had those three children. I had a little girl, seven, a little boy. I had the little girl, seven. We had 2 6 and 2 5 when we got married. We started out with all the hopes and dreams that I had ever dreamed possible. One of his little girls made her home with us, and one of them lived with her mother. When we'd been married 2 years, this man adopted my children, and he was their all the daddy they ever really remembered. And he loved us, and he loved my children, and we loved him. And we had so many hopes and so many plans and so many dreams. And our children were going to be the hope and the dreams of our future. And I had lived such a fast life during that 9 years that I honky-tonked and went around and did all the things I did in my first 9-year marriage that I'd gained quite a reputation. And I became real proud of myself that I'd found this man, or he'd found me, and I was married, and I'd changed my way of life. And I was picking myself up out of that muck and that mire that I had wallowed in for 9 years. And I was not the person that these people had made me into. And so I was so proud of myself, and I had this problem with pride. And I was so proud of myself, and I had this pride thing, this ego thing, that there was a little newspaper down in our town called the Bixby Bulletin. Came out every Friday. Long about every Wednesday, I went down there. And I took a big, long article. I wrote it myself. Most of it was true. Some of it I stretched. And it was about one of my children, what they had won, some award they'd won. Because my children, we were on farm. They showed horses and pigs and cows and things at the fair. My oldest son learned to fly. He soloed. We had an airplane. He soloed when he was 16. My daughter was queen of this and queen of that. So I had a lot of things to brag about. And I was always down there at the papers with this big story. And what I would always say was, son of Carl and June Christensen. And this was real important to me because I knew just down the road, 10 miles, lived the natural family of my children. And they were going to read this. And this was going to gig them just a little bit, you know. And that's what I wanted to have happen. So I learned a lesson real early on, long before I came to this program. And I'll get to that in a little bit, about what your pride and your ego and that kind of thing can do to you. But that's kind of the way I live my life. And it became real important for us to look like the all-American family, no matter what was going on in that home, no matter if there was strife and problems and things like that, and there were. My kids began to get in trouble at school, and I began to lie and cover up and not tell Carl. And I began to blame and find someone to put the blame off on. And I was sleeping with the enemy. You know, it was him. I blamed Carl. I knew it was his fault that this kid got in trouble at school, because my boys worked real hard. They were field hands. We all worked hard. We worked on the farm. We worked hard. And I would say things to myself like, he makes them work too hard, and that's why they didn't do well in school. And blah, blah. You know, I made up all this stuff. And so I started that pattern very early on in that marriage. And so no matter what it was going on in there or going on inside me, I made it a point that we looked like the all-American family when we stepped out of that house. We looked like it so well that 1 year we were awarded in Washington, D.C. for the Outstanding Farm Family of the Year. And let me tell you, I stood up there and accepted that award, and my mind was whirling. I wonder where those kids are. I bet they're out doing this and doing that. You know, I really pretended. I pretended a lot, and things were beginning to happen in my world of pretend, and it was going kind of sour. When my daughter was 16 years old, my oldest child was 16 years old, she went to a birthday party one night. And a phone rang in the middle of the night. Well, it wasn't in the middle of the night because they had come home by midnight. Phone rang and the lady said, "You're going to have to come get her. She's drunk." Carl answered the phone, or I probably would have made up some kind of a tale why I had to rush out in the middle of the night and pick up a kid, but Carl had to go get her. And he brought her home, and he sat her down in a rocking chair in my living room. And I can see it as vividly as I see your face. The old chair just flopped back and forth, and that kid sitting there in it, her head just loose. And he told her she was a tramp. And there was a feeling that started within my gut that night that I never knew was possible for me to have for this man. And it grew with me over the years until it almost destroyed the love that I had for him and that I have for him today. And that was the first experience we had with alcohol in that home. Shortly after that, when my young son, my oldest son, was 16, my husband took him to town and bought him a brand new car because we had not paid him wages through the years he worked in the fields. And my husband brought him a brand new car, and not long after he bought that car for him, we got a call that he was in jail in Tulsa. My husband went and got him because he had always told the boys that he'd get them one time and that was all. I told him that, and I got them many times. My husband stuck with his story. We went and got the boy out of the jail and brought him home and sat him down and asked him to explain. And this is what he said. He said, "It was not my fault. It was not my fault, Mama." He always directed it right to me, and I'm just sitting there, you know, nodding, taking it all in. He said, "You are not going to believe this, but I..." There was a car just exactly like mine. It passed me going 100 miles an hour. Right down on South Sheridan, it was going at least 100 miles an hour. I was driving on a speed limit. I'd had one beer, and first thing I know, cop lights are on, and they stop me, they jerk me out, and they take me to jail. Well, I just immediately started blaming the cops. You know, we ought to do something about that. We need to. And my husband looked at me, and he said, "June, don't you know that boy's lying through his teeth?" And I had that feeling again. I had that feeling again. And pretty soon, those two kids and Carl's little daughter that lived with us, and she never gave us any grief of any kind. She's a lovely girl, has a lovely home, and has two beautiful little grandchildren for us. And the first three children went away to college. And Regina was the first one to go. And she went up to Miami, Oklahoma to college, and when summer came, she came to Tulsa, and she stayed in Tulsa in an apartment. About 2 o'clock in the morning one night, the phone rang, and it was the law. And they said to me, "We have arrested your daughter, and we have her on drug charges, and she's up in the Tulsa County Jail." And we got Pat up, that was the boy next to her, and we asked him if he knew anything about that, and he said no. About 5 o'clock in the morning, they were knocking on the door. And they come after him. Same charge. We did the only thing we knew to do. We went to my daddy because my daddy had the money to help us, to get us out of that trouble. And that happened on Wednesday night. And on Friday morning, that Bixby Bulletin came out. And that paper said, "Patrick and Regina Christensen, the son and daughter of Carl and June Christensen, are being held in the Tulsa County Jail on possession of drugs." And I was not the one that took that story to that paper. I never went back to that paper. I did not subscribe to it any longer. I never took them another story. I thought they were tacky. And I hung my head in shame because in 1971, in a small farming community in Bixby, Oklahoma, a family that was like ours, these were things that did not happen. This was the first of its kind in our community. We were devastated. We were ashamed. And I blamed my husband. It must be his fault. It must be his fault. And so my daddy came and got my husband and me, and we all four, my mother, my daddy, my husband Carl, we all four went up to the courthouse. Now, I told my husband all the way up there how to behave. And my husband never did mind me. He doesn't mind. He still does not mind me. And I spent many years trying to get that man to mind me. And my husband is a sure enough Oklahoma cowboy. He's the kind of man that wears Wranglers. and a suit coat, a suede coat, a sports coat, a good hat, a pair of boots. He doesn't own a pair of shoes. And so I said to him, don't go up there and stomp around all over that courthouse and act ugly and say things that are ugly and embarrass me and hurt my feelings and make Mom and Daddy think you're ugly. Just please. And he just went up there and acted awful, just awful. And I just felt terrible about him. You know, I just didn't know it was possible for this thing to grow inside me like it was. Those kids, we got those kids out of that trouble, and shortly after that, they both left home, and they went on their way. We had owned a ranch in Okmulgee County, and that was about another 20 miles south. And so we moved on that ranch. We left that little small community, and we took the last kid we had at home, who was Mike, and we moved on that ranch, and things got worse. This Mike, when he got out of high school, he began to drink and drug just like they did. My daughter by that time was a nurse. She was working in doctor's offices and hospitals. My boy was, Pat, by that time was flying spray planes for a living. And they were drinking and they were drugging and they were driving us all crazy. It was, you know, it's really, I don't know how, looking back, it's no wonder to me I asked someone to push me in a wheelchair down through that airport. I mean, you keep up with three drunk kids, and you're nuttier than a fruitcake, and you got a husband you're trying to hide everything from, and you're trying to smile and look like the all-American family. You know, you'll do anything. You got to have a lot of guts. And I did a lot of things that I'm ashamed of today. I did the things that we do when we're trying to hide someone's drinking. I covered up bad checks. I paid rent. I got them out of jail. I lied, I deceived, I cheated, I did everything we do to try to protect those kids. I called in many times that they were sick, and I did all these things without ever discussing it with my husband. We never discussed those children. When my boys, when they were home, looked real good. When they were drinking, they got to coming around looking really weird. They had long hair. They had headbands on. They had earrings in their ears. They rode a motorcycle. They looked really weird. And when my husband would look up and see one of those boys coming, he'd go to the barn. And he would not come out of that barn until they left. And when they left and he came out of the barn and they were gone, and he would come in and he'd say, "What'd they want?" And I'd say, "Oh, nothing. They just came by. Say hi. You know, sorry they missed you. But what they wanted was some money." And I would give that money to them, and as I shook it in their face and handed it to them, I would say to them, "Will you promise me? Will you promise me if I give you this that you won't drink anymore?" And of course they promised me that. And the thing I know today that I did not know then was my children or anybody you love never set out with the intent to do harm. My children never set out to lie to me. They were doing all they knew to do to get what it took to keep them going one more day. And they had to have that booze, those drugs, and they took that money and they made those promises. And I knew they were lying. I knew it then and I know it today. I knew they were lying. But thank God I know today that they did not, that was not their intent. I love an alcoholic, and I am so proud to be able to say that. I love an alcoholic because the alcoholics in my life are my children. When I look back on that young man I married in 1951 who was an alcoholic, and I did not know that, I looked at him as low life, yellow-bellied, lily-livered, no account. I mean, you name it, I called him that. And today, I'm able to look at him with a compassion that I look on any other person on this earth that drinks. I am glad that this program has given me that. And so that was the way things would go. Sometimes Carl would manage to get to the barn, and the kid would drive up, and Carl would just walk out and say, "You get the hell off my property," and they were gone. And I would have to meet them places in order to see them and give them the money they needed to go on. And I began, and this feeling I had for this man, this love I had for this man, just began to disappear. It just began to go down the toilet. It just wasn't there anymore. And holidays were the absolute worst experience of my life. If they showed up at all, the boys, I would start out weeks before a holiday trying to gather them all up. You know, be sure you're here. Be sure you're there. Get them some clothes. Get them to looking good. Clean them up. Tell them how to act, what to say. Then I would tell Carl, Carl, please don't act like that today. Please, when they come, do this and do that. And then I was their personal shopper. Now, I would get around, because I knew Pat and Mike weren't going to show up with a Christmas present. Now, Regina always showed up with some little something. She always looked decent. Pat and Mike just looked like scum of the earth. They'd show up all cut up, beat up, black eyes, weird looking. You know, I didn't know where their good clothes went, that I had just bought them. And they told me that someone stole them. And I believed them. Lord, I thought someone was just going around just stealing all their clothes all the time. You know? And so I'd go out and I'd buy these presents. And what I'd usually buy for my husband, for the boys to give my husband, was a book. And I would disguise my handwriting. And I'd write in that book, to Daddy, with lots of love from Pat. And one from Mike. And then I'd get around when Pat and Mike finally showed up, and I'd whisper to him, I got your daddy a book. Now, when he opens it, act like you know what it is, because I don't want him knowing that I did. You know, and that's how I operated. And then I monitored the behavior that went on in that house. I stood around, draw it up in a knot. You all know that feeling, don't you? Draw it up in a knot and watched what happened in that house. And I watched my husband. And I watched him open that gift. And I wanted him to say, oh, look, everybody, this is what Pat and Mike got me. Isn't that nice? And my husband would open that book and look at it and shut it and never say a word. And I said to myself, you ruined my Christmas. You did it again. You ruined my Christmas. And I blamed him some more. And so I decided that Army would straighten my boy out. So I got the Army. I'd line him out to go to the Army. I sent Pat to the Army, and they sent him to Germany, and he didn't do very good over there. He got over there, and and they sent him back. It seemed like no matter where I sent them, the recipients always sent him back. Always. But he got over there, and I got a letter one day, and the letter said, your boy is over here, and he's hospitalized with a heroin addiction. And so I thought I had to keep another secret. You know, I couldn't tell anybody that. And I did the only thing I knew to do in those days, and I fell upon my knees, and I prayed the prayer of my childhood. I prayed to the God of my childhood. And my prayer went like this. God, if you'll sober him up, this is what I'll do. And if you'll sober them up, I won't do that anymore. Because I figured that somehow or other I was being punished by a God that was punishing me for the way I had lived those 9 years. I figured this was, and if I could get good enough, he would hear my prayer and he would answer it and my kids would get sober. And I'm so happy to report that I don't have to believe that anymore. I can report to you tonight that I pray to a God that's full of compassion and loves me unconditionally. And that is one of the sweetest gifts that this program has been able to give me. But that's what I did that day. And soon I got a letter that said that boy was being shipped home. And Lord, I did not know what I was going to do. It got so bad in my house. There was just a nothingness. Just a nothingness. You know, I couldn't watch programs about alcoholism and drug addiction. I couldn't listen to anybody talk about it. My husband did. And my husband would say to me, June, if you want to sit around with your head in the sand, go ahead. But those kids are on drugs. And they're drinking, and they need some kind of help. And I hated him some more because he said that to me. I could not face the reality of what was going on within my family. I could not talk about it. I pretended it did not happen. And so that boy was coming home, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And so I went to my family doctor, who was a friend of ours, a man that we socialized with. He knew our family inside and out. He treated my children. He had treated my young son, Mike, for a self-inflicted gunshot wound about a week prior to me going to him. And I went to him and I said, there's something really bad wrong with me. And I need you to put me in the hospital and run a bunch of tests. And I need you to put me in there on this day, and I need you to keep me about 8 days, and then I'll be okay to go home. And he said, June, are you going through a lot of stuff in your home? And I said, well, of course not. I'm just sick. And I was sick. By that time, I'd had a couple of back surgeries. I had a big ulcer. I was on heart medication. I was sleeping a lot. There was a dark spot in my bedroom on the floor between the wall and my bed. And I'd go in there and lie down in that place and sleep for hours. I was taking the phone off the hook at night so it would not ring and I wouldn't have to hear that news, whatever it was that someone was calling me to say. I was doing a lot of sick things. I was going to town and I was buying things that I didn't need and things I didn't even want. I was redoing my house. I was buying a better car. I was doing all these things that I thought would take my mind off of the things that was going on within me. And none of it was working. And when you do all that stuff and none of it works, you get sick. You get sick. You're sick when you start, and you get sicker and sicker and sicker. So Tom put me in the hospital. I knew they wouldn't come up there and argue over the bed of a dying woman, and I was right. They all came one at a time. And pretty soon my boy left and went on his way. And I got out of that hospital and life went on. I got him a job out in Calipatra, California. There was a man out there that owed me a favor and I called it in one day. He owned a feedlot out there and I sent that boy out there. And he got along so good I sent Mike out there. And Mike got along pretty good out there too until they all came home again. But Mike called me up one time and he was in Tulsa and he said he was going to shoot himself. And I said, don't do that. Wait till I get up there, and I'll fix it. And I did the only thing I knew to do. I took a pocket full of money, and I went up there, and I said, what would it take not to get you to kill yourself? And he put a price on it, and I paid him. And he got in an old pickup, and he came to Ohio. And that's where he was when he sobered up finally. You see, it was always real necessary for me to distance myself from my problem. And I often wonder, as I stand at these podiums and tell you all my story, what you must be thinking. What kind of a mother was she? I was a good mother. I was a really good mother. I was a mother that loved my children. But I was a mother. I was the kind of mother, and if you are like me, you're the kind of mother that's capable of killing your kids out of love. And that's the kind of mother I was. I was the kind of mother that would do what happened to me in the airport. I'd put a big old kid in a wheelchair and push him down an aisle. And you would walk up to me and you would say, I'm so sorry, your son can't walk. And I could reply to you, oh, he can walk. He don't have to. I'm going to push him. I was the kind of mother that would not let my children suffer through what they had to suffer. Not let them come out of this thing they had to come out of. I was always sliding right in there and picking them up and setting them up for another fall. It's a thousand wonders my God did not remove me from the face of this earth because I continually got in his way. I would not stay out of his way. I was always so sure that I had the answer and it was my responsibility to give it to you. I knew it was. I knew that's what I was here for. That's the kind of mother I was. I was the kind of mother that could not stand to look at what was going on with my children. So I sent them far away from me. And I could imagine things. I could imagine they were fine. I couldn't look at the reality of what was really happening in the life of my children. I could not hardly stand what was happening in my home. When my boy came to Ohio, his drinking progressed and got worse. His drugging got worse. He grew a long beard and long hair. And one night along about 11 o'clock, that telephone rang, and it was him. And when I answered it, he sounded a little different. And that boy said to me, "Mama, I've been down on my knees up here, and I have given my soul to the Lord. I've come up a saved man, and I'm going to preach." And I said to him, "You can't do that. You can't do that, Mike. You never even graduated out of high school." My Mike was in the jail when his high school class graduated at Okmulgee. And he said, "Oh, yeah, I can." And that boy cleaned himself up, and he went up to a little Bible college in Marietta, Ohio, and he told him his story. And he took a test that he needed to take to get his high school diploma, and he got that diploma, and he enrolled himself in that college. And that boy called me and told me how much money it was going to cost, and I sent that money to him. And when he'd been in that college for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, he called me one time and he told me that he wanted to go to Belfast in Northern Ireland, and he wanted to study over there with Dr. Ian Paisley. And I sent him the money to go on and the money to live on while he was over there that year and a half. And he preached and he studied all over that country. And when he came home from Belfast in Northern Ireland, he came to Greenville, South Carolina, to Bob Jones University, to finish up his degree in theology. And I asked him what it cost, and he told me, and I sent that money to him. Not one time did I ask my husband if I had permission. And worst of all, not one time did it ever even enter my mind to say, "God, is this your will? Is this your will for me, and is this your will for that boy?" That was that kid's will and my will, and I didn't care who I got in the way of. I just steamrolled over everything and made it happen. And that boy preached for 8 years. And I believe, as an old Southern Baptist girl with all my heart, that when that young boy got up off his knees that day in Marietta, Ohio, he got up off his knees a saved and redeemed man. I also believe that he had an experience sufficient to secure him a place in heaven hereafter. I also believe when he got up off his knees that day, he got up an alcoholic, not able to go to the people he needed to be with to help him with that problem. The clergy was not able, and so he was lost. And after he preached for 8 years because of bitter disappointment through that church, he crawled back in that bottle where he is today. I had two kids drunk and one kid preaching, and I had a halo on my head that I thought I had done the best. And people told me I did. You know, they'd say, "Oh, June, you did such a good job." And I just thanked them. And I was just proud of myself once more. You know, I was just really proud of myself. And the preacher would come home, and now we got two kids out there drunk, and I got to watch how the preacher and the daddy act toward the drunk kids. And I got to monitor all that again. And, you know, still yet I'm in there doing all the monitoring. And it wasn't all that fun. You know, it wasn't all that fun. It was getting kind of bad. We moved off that ranch in 1984. We sold our ranch and we moved to a small place up where we live today toward Tulsa. We were out working on a horse barn. Some people were there building a horse barn. And then we heard that spray plane coming. If you're familiar with those spray planes like we are in our part of the country, they have a different sound. We heard that plane coming, and it looked like that boy was going to fly it right down the hallway of that barn. My husband looked up, and he said, "That boy is drunk, and he's going to kill himself." And I never will forget what I said to him. "How in the world do you know he's drunk? He's up there, and you're down here. Now, how do you know that?" And he said to me, "Ah, June, too many times, I know he's drunk." At 9 o'clock that night, that telephone rang, and it was that boy. And he said, "Mama, I've got to have some help." And boy, he called the right person, because I was ready, and just in case anybody ever... If they ever did call for help, by that time I had heard about treatment centers. I knew a man. My daughter had married into a family where the man had been a drunk for many years. He was in the oil business in Tulsa, and they were a wealthy family. And he had gone into a treatment center at St. John's in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he came out sober, and he was doing wonderful things, and I'd heard all about it. So I had got some information on that, just in case anybody ever wanted. And so that boy... The boy called me and asked me for help, and so I had help lined up. And I said, you come on, and I called them, and they told me they had a bed for him and for me to bring him up there. So I got that kid, and I went by. By that time, he'd got married. He'd got married, and, I forgot to tell you one thing I did on Thanksgiving one time with him after he got married. I thought maybe if he had a responsibility, like bringing part of the food, that he'd show up, and he had a little girl. And, Lord, he drank the first 4 years of that little girl's life. And I just thought maybe, you know, if he had the responsibility of something as big as like the turkey. So I said, you bring the turkey. And he said he'd be happy to. And Thanksgiving morning, I never will forget it, his little wife called me up just, gosh, she was just sobbing. She said, June, he's been gone for 2 days and he's got the turkey. And I don't know. And I don't know where he is. And she said, but you know, drugs are smart because my boy knew that something like that might happen. He allowed for that. And so he took the turkey to a man to have it smoked. He gave instructions to the man that smoked the turkey. If I don't get back, you take that to my granddaddy and my granddaddy will deliver it to my mama. And that's how we got the turkey. That boy woke up in a blackout drunk somewhere up in Missouri about a week later. I always love to tell that part of that story because that, I mean, I don't recommend that. Don't ever give somebody that's drinking the responsibility of bringing the mainstay for a Thanksgiving, as it might not work. But anyway, I went by and got his wife, and he didn't look to suit me, so I took him, got his hair cut, cleaned him up, told him what to say all the way up here. Told her what to say and told him what to say. I did not want that boy to go in there and talk about the relationship that was going on in my house. I did not want him to go in there and talk about his daddy. I was afraid he'd say something about his daddy, and they might want his daddy to come up there, and all hell would break loose, and I just didn't want that to happen. And I didn't want them to think we were white trash. And so I just said, you know, Mary, you say this and say this, and I wouldn't tell him about that, and I'd leave this part out and this part. And so I went traipsing right in there with him. And so I went in and I introduced myself and the kid, and I told them, you know, what I thought they ought to hear. And they said, why don't you just go on home? Just blew my mind. I thought, surely, I just loud as hell that by the time I got through with them, they'd try hiring me or something, you know. But they told me to go home and probably stay there. And so I went home, and there was I went back to see him from time to time, and I never told his daddy that he could go there. I never did tell him he could go up there because I was afraid that something would be said that would you know, I was always trying to shield someone's feelings, stand in between. And so I went by to get my daughter one day to take her up there to see her brother. And she'd been living in this apartment for like 10 years. And I walked in there that day, and it looked like she'd just moved in there. I mean, it was trashed. And she was laying there all huddled up in a fetal position, sicker than a dog. She suffered a great deal those days with the virus, she said, and I believed her. And so I said, honey, what's wrong? And she said, oh, Mama, it's that virus again. And I asked her if I could get her anything, and she said no. And so I went on up to the hospital to visit with Pat, and I told Pat about her and the condition she was in. And he said to me, Mama, do you not know what's wrong with her? And I said, well, of course I know. You know, she's got a virus that she suffers with a lot. And he said, Mama, she is strung out on drugs, and she's drinking, and she needs to be up here. And I turned on that boy like a rattlesnake. I couldn't stand to hear that from him, no more than I could stand to hear it from his daddy. A month later, they fished her out of a swimming pool unconscious and took her to that same treatment center, where I'm proud to say they both sobered up. My kids were really, really lucky. They fell into a treatment center that pushed AA. they fell into a treatment center that told them, you better get some strong sponsorship and you better be in a meeting somewhere every single day for 90 days. They fell in with a sponsor that said to my son, when he said, I can't come tonight, it's my daughter's birthday. And that sponsor looked at him and said, where were you last year on her birthday? And he said, I was somewhere drunk. And he said, you show up at that meeting tonight, and maybe next year you can celebrate that birthday. They fell in with some big book sponsors. And because of the kind of sponsorship they fell in with, and because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, those two kids are celebrating 12 and 13 years. 12 years, they're coming up on 12 years. Those kids got out of that treatment center, and the first thing they did was buy me a big book, and they brought it home and asked me if I thought I might like to go to Al-Anon. I never was, so I can't tell you how I felt, but I just said to myself, those got to be the two most ungrateful, snot-nosed kids I ever saw in my life. And I did say to them, you want me to go to Al-Anon? Why don't you all get your daddy to go? He's the one that acted like the horse's rear. He's the one that ran you off. He's the one that would not put up with you. Look who you're talking to. I paid your rent. I took care of your baby. I paid your jail tickets. I did all these things, and you want me to go to Al-Anon? I don't think so. No, I don't think so, but I will read that book. And I read that book, and the reason I read that book was because they told me at the hospital that my children suffered with a disease called alcoholism. Now, if I'd taken my children in there and they'd have said, you got two kids that are really sick, lady, and they have leukemia, I'd have gone out and bought a book, or all the books I could find, about the disease of leukemia. And I would have read it so I could accept it and understand it. And so I began to read that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is how I read it. I found things in that book that reminded me of them, and I wrote their names out in the margin. I wrote Carl and Mike and Pat and Regina. And the day came when that book is most precious to me now. The day came when I had to go back and scratch those names out and put my own in there because I relate to that book big time. Well, things began to get a little bit better around our house. Kids began to bring home a few sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous on holidays, and I began to see there was a different way of life. These people had something different. You know, I'd been around sober people all my life, people that did not drink, but I had not been around sober people. These people had something different. It was like we never met or something. And so I was just intrigued with them. And they were, I spent a great deal of time around them. I began, my two sober kids picked me up and kept asking me about going to Al-Anon, and I kept saying no. And one day, just out of the deep gut feeling I had, I went to the telephone on a Saturday afternoon, and I called the church up in Marietta, Ohio, and I asked the pastor of that church about my boy. And he told me he was laying drunk, and he'd been drunk for a few days. And I was absolutely, totally devastated. I did not know how in the tarnation I was going to keep another secret like that. How was I going to keep that secret? And so my daddy had a habit of coming to my house on Sunday morning before we went to church and bringing donuts. And we'd sit around and visit and have coffee. And on Sunday morning, just as my daddy was walking in, I stood up out of my bed. I had absolutely no voice of any kind, and I was not able to breathe. I was gasping for air like you would if you were having a bad asthma attack, and I passed out. And so my husband picked me up and carried me up to the emergency room at St. John's, or St. Francis in Tulsa. It frightened my daddy so badly that he called my kids. My boy by that time was down in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and he called that boy to come home, and he called Regina to come home. She was wherever, and he called her to come home. And they all came to the hospital, and they worked on me all day long at that hospital. And when the day was over, I was able to breathe, and I was able to talk, and they did not know what was wrong with me, but I knew. My husband took me home at night, and he took me back on the, and laid me on a bed in my bedroom and closed the door, and my young son, Pat, came in and sat down beside me. By that time, Pat was working as a counselor in a treatment center in Fort Smith, Arkansas. He was, by that time, he was skilled in the formal intervention skills. And he sat down beside me and he said, "Mama, do you want to tell me what's wrong with you?" And I just shook my head, "No." And he said, "Mama, is it about Mike?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "He's drinking, isn't he?" And I said, "How in the world did you know?" And he said, "Oh, we saw it coming a long time ago. And I know today what it is he talked about." You know, when you stay real connected and real close to this program, you can see these relapses coming, whether you drink or you don't drink. Our behavior changes. Our attitudes change. We dress differently. We just act differently. And then we slip. You know, we slip and we drink, or we go back into this insane behavior for those of us who cannot get comfort from the bottle. And so you can see it coming. And this boy had looked and he knew what was happening to his brother. Next morning, he went to my sister that evening. My sister gave him the money to get on a plane and come to Columbus, Ohio, where the preacher of that church, a committee from that church, met him and took him where that boy was. And he picked him up and he brought him and put him in a treatment center in Columbus, Ohio. And that boy stayed in there for 2 weeks. And he came out and he drank again. And I did the only thing I knew to do along about that time, and that was to send him some money to come home on if he wanted to come home. And he said he did, and he was married by that time. It was over the holidays of Labor Day. He came home, and he stayed home 2 weeks, and it was absolutely the worst 2 weeks of my life. I was so drawn into a knothole that I could hardly stand my own skin. I was so scared that he was going to drink and everybody was going to know. My two sober kids, I think, had threatened him with his life if he drank. And bless his heart, somehow he managed to stay sober during that time. The day arrived when I was to take him to the airport and send him back to Marietta, Ohio, and I was glad, once again, to separate myself from this problem. And I didn't ask anybody to go with me, and I went out to that airport. And I put that boy and his young wife on that plane. And I came back out in the halls, the corridor of the Tulsa International Airport. And I backed up against the wall. And I just slithered down it. And I put my head down on my knees. And I began to sob as if I had put a corpse on that plane. Because I knew the gig was up. I knew that my fix wasn't working anymore. I knew that I didn't have the money. I didn't have the power. I didn't have the know-how. I had nothing available to help that boy, and I knew it that day. I heard that little old girl coming down that airport corridor, her little feet just clicking. And that little old Regina, she came out there that day and she got on the plane, told her little brother and her little sister-in-law goodbye. And she came back and she sat down beside me in that airport that day, and we stayed a couple hours. And she said to me the most precious thing, the thing that the people of Alcoholics Anonymous had said to her, "Mama, this is where you're going to learn about surrender and release." And she told me, she shared with me patiently and lovingly this precious story that you all had given to her. Mamas are supposed to teach their children. But my two sober kids took me by the hand, and they walked with me through the most difficult period of my life. That was in September. In October, they took me to my very first conference, 1987. We went down there and we shared a little cabin much like this. It was at a state park, a lodge in Oklahoma. Not this beautiful, but a lot like this. And there I met the lady that would become my sponsor, and her name was Ramona. I heard my first Al-Anon speaker, and her name was Sue D. out of California. We had become very close friends. Sue Drum stood at a podium like this, and she said, "You need to learn to say some things like, 'You could be right.' You need to learn..." She said, you know, I don't remember. I was with Sue last weekend at a deal, and I told Sue, I said, you know, I remember what you had on and how you looked. And I remember a few of the things you said. And a few of those things were, you could be right. You need to take recovery at home, she said. If there's no recovery in the home, there's no recovery. That's where you got sick. And you need to take recovery at home, she said. And those are the things that she said that were welded in my mind. And so I stumbled into my first Al-Anon meeting. As I said a while ago, lost and lonely and scared. I did not go there to find out anything that I know today. I went there to find out how to sober up that kid and get Carl to mind me. And I knew... I knew if I could get that kid sober, I've already got two kids sober. I have got two kids sober. If I can get the other one sober and I can get Carl to mind me, my life will come together and everything will be fine. I knew that. And I went down there and I found out some stuff that blew my head. I found out that I was the kind of woman that had a resentment and an anger and an ugliness inside her that I never knew existed in me. I found out, you know, I had straightened up my life. I didn't lay out in honky-tonks anymore. I didn't do the things I did in that first 9 years. There were a lot of things that on the surface I had changed. But my behavior on the inside was just like it had always been and getting worse. I was hateful. I was mean. I was jealous. I was self-righteous. I pitied myself. I had an ego this big. I had all this stuff, and that's what you all told me. Now, that should make anybody want to turn tail and run. But I'm going to tell you something. That was some of the most precious and valuable information that this lady has ever received in her life. Because of that, I am not the same woman that walked into that meeting. I am not the same woman I used to be. I am a woman today that can sit out here on a bench and look out across a beautiful lake and be alone with her and her God. And I don't have to drink from the cup anymore. My cup runneth over. I can drink from the saucer today because my cup is so full. And that's what you gave me. That's some of the stuff that you gave me. And then God began to do these things for me. He began to let me have miracles in my life. And if you're here and you haven't experienced, if you're so new that you have not experienced these beautiful, wonderful things, don't leave a minute too soon because they're out there. And I'm going to share a few of them with you. But I got to tell you the first thing I did. I went home and Carl said something that aggravated me and I looked him straight in the face and I said, "You could be right." And his jaw fell about right here. And I went down the hall to the bathroom and I got out on my knees and I began to pray. And my prayer went like this. God, help me keep my mouth shut. Prior to that, I would have said, God, shut his mouth so I can explain this to him and he'll understand. So see, I began to get some progress. God let me see my oldest boy, Pat, got remarried. And we went down for that wedding and my whole family went. And we were all standing around there, my daddy, my mama, my sister, and my children. Mike was not there. But we were all there, and I got to see, as vividly as I see you, the first miracle. And I saw my big old daddy. My daddy was 6'4" and weighed 260 pounds, and he wasn't fat. He was just big. And as we stood there and watched that young man get married, and that little girl, 9 years old, his little daughter, stood there beside him. And she looked up in her daddy's face like she could eat him alive. And I saw the healing of this program for the first time. Because this was the little girl that used to run and hide in the closet when her daddy came in because she was scared of him. And she stood there looking at him, absolutely adoring him. And I looked over at my big old daddy. The tears were streaming down his face. And I remembered that day in 1971 that we stood in that judge's chambers. And with the money in one hand and the fist in the air like this, he said to that man, "You must be wrong. Be real sure you're not wrong about my grandchildren. This could not have happened to them." My little old mama, about this tall, had run out in the road one day and stopped that pickup and took that tiny baby girl away from that drunken young man. And there we all were. My little old daughter, Regina, was standing there dressed up in a purple dress, and she literally radiated the beauty of this program that you had given her. I remembered the days that I'd taken that girl to the mall to try to dress her up. That little girl was a full-blown hippie, and she did not want to dress up. And she stood there that day just gorgeous, beautiful, within and without. That girl, I'm proud to report, is the kind of drunk that doesn't care to get puked on. She's the kind of drunk that we need, the recovering alcoholic that we need, that will go out there and pick up a wet drunk and work with them. And that's what she does. And I'm so happy that she's able to do that. She loves an alcoholic also. She loves them all. And so we started home that evening. And I turned around and I saw for the first time in all those years, I had never seen my husband put his hands on his sons in affection. I turned around and looked back, and there he stood with his arms locked around that young man, tears streaming down his face, and he was telling him how much he loved him and how proud he was of him. And I knew my first miracle. My first miracle came to me that night, and there were many, many more. After I'd been in this program about 4 years, this boy up in Ohio got sober, and he stayed sober about a year, and he moved home. And it was the happiest time of my life. I had him right down the road from me, and every morning he came, and he had donuts with me. I made him breakfast. He started up a little venture with his daddy. We started raising some running dogs. And we'd go out and do chores, and Mike, he's my funnest kid. You know, we just have fun. He'd shoot me with a water hose, or he'd rope me with the rope, and we'd just do things. We'd just die laughing. We'd just have fun. And I saw it coming. You know, I saw it coming. And he was drunk, and he was bad. And he had his back operated on for the third time, and he was hooked up on those prescription pills, and he was laying crazy in the streets of Tulsa. And I thought he was going to die. And I began to doubt my recovery. I was here 4 years. I'd seen the miracles. I knew God had spoke to my life and to my family. I'd watched the recovery. And I began to doubt the recovery that I had. And I doubted your recovery, and I doubted the books, and I doubted my God even. I doubted it all. And I came home one night from a meeting on Tuesday night, and there sat Pat's car from Arkansas about 10 o'clock that night. And I went inside my house, and there was my husband and my Pat sitting there at a table, at the kitchen table, and my husband was crying. And I said, has something happened? And he said, oh, June, I had to call Pat to help me. I didn't know what else to do. He said, it's that boy. That's how we refer to Mike, is that boy. It's that boy. He's driving me crazy. I don't know what to do. He's going to die. And I sat down with Pat, and I told Pat what I felt. And I said, I can't leave him alone. The people in AA and the people in Al-Anon are telling me to keep my hands off that boy. I don't think I can do that. And he told me this. He said, Mama, God don't need you to do his stuff. God has people out there to reach that boy. God uses people to reach people, and he does not need you to go up there and rescue that boy. Leave him alone. And I said to him, but Pat, I'm afraid he's going to die drunk and he won't know I love him. And he said, he may die drunk, but he knows you love him. Not everybody that comes through these doors gets recovery. And so it may happen. And so we sat up way into the night that night. And as I started down the hall to my bedroom, I turned around and I looked back, and God let me see something for the first time that night. I had been the kind of Al-Anon that was brought into, I was brought up on the big book. I did my steps on the big, on the 12 and 12 of AA. My sponsor strongly suggested that I do that, and she strongly suggested that I couple it with the material from Al-Anon, and I did that. But every morning I was on my knees saying the third step prayer. God, relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. And I looked back at that man that night, and I saw a broken man. And I saw for the first time the pain and the agony that that man was in. And for the first time, I realized what I had done to him with my tongue. I had stripped a man who had taken a family and loved us to shreds. I had stripped him of all the dignity that he had. I had not tried to understand him. I didn't even know he hurt. And I looked at him that night, and I knew for the first time that he, that my children drank because they had a hole they were trying to fill up. And I was like an insane, crazy, controlling person because I was trying to fill up an empty space in my gut. And that man raged for the same reason. And I saw it for the first time. And I said to myself, I hit my knees that night, and I said to myself, God, if you allow me another day, I will spend the rest of my life being eternally grateful and making amends to this man. And I started that on that day, and I want to report to you tonight that that husband of mine of 35 years and I are sweethearts today. I called him last night. And I reported to him what a wonderful time I was having. And he told me to report to y'all that he sent you his best. And that was me. And that's what he thinks. You know, it healed a marriage. This program healed a marriage when I got out of the way and allowed it to do so. And so I started to work the next morning, and I'm still, my mind just twirling, you know, and I don't know what to do. And one more time, God put a miracle in my life. He allowed a man to come to my office that shouldn't have been there. I had no reason in the world to be in that area. Came in there, sat down, and shared with me one more time the beautiful story. And I was able to go home that night and leave that boy alone. I was able to let him stay up there in Tulsa, and he moved on to Dallas. And sometimes he gets sober, and sometimes he's sober for nearly a year. And when he is, he comes home. And Lord, we have the best times. We just have the best times. We had the most wonderful holiday last year on Christmas. And we don't even do Christmas presents anymore. You know, we draw names, and we do a little incidental Christmas gift, because we have so much to be grateful for. And we had such a wonderful Christmas. And he called me in March, and he said, Mama, on the 8th day of March, I'm going to be sober. On the 8th day of March, I'm going to have the same job a year. And on the 22nd day of March, I'm going to be sober a year. And shortly before that happened, they found him laying in the streets of Dallas, almost dead. And they took him to the hospital down there, and they put him in a lockup ward because he had been in that hospital three times that week in the emergency room. I called some people in AA and some people in Al-Anon and told them what had happened. The hospital called my son, it's in Fort Smith now, and told him that they had Mike down there. And they came home, my children came home, and my husband and me and my two sober children, we sat down and we talked about what to do. And we decided to do nothing except pray and love him from afar and leave him in the hands of a merciful and loving God and let someone, God would allow someone to work with this boy. On Father's Day, he called his daddy from that institution, and he was barely able to talk. But his daddy stood there with tears in his eyes, and he said, I miss you too, Mike, and I love you. This was the daddy that used to go out and say, get the hell off my land. And he understands today because we share this program with one another. 4th of July, that boy called me and he said, Mama, I didn't have a drink today. And I had to go to Hobbs, New Mexico about 6 weeks ago. I got to go to Hobbs, New Mexico. And he met me at the airport, and it was the first time I'd got to see him since Christmas. And he looked great. He lost his pickup, and he had to ride a bicycle all over the streets of Dallas. And we just laughed about it, and I was able, you know, one, just for a fleeting minute, just for a second, that thought, you know, our old ways are our first ways. And it came back to me, I can get that pickup. And I went so far as to say to my husband, you know, it's a shame. He doesn't owe very much money on that truck. And my husband said, June, I don't think so. And, you know, it's so wonderful when you've been so alienated to not have to keep secrets. And when my heart would break at night, I can roll over and let this man hold me in his arms and cry. I can get out of bed and get on my knees and pray, and I'm not ashamed. I don't have to get up and go hide and cry. I don't have to do that anymore, because y'all taught me about this, see. You taught me these things. I always whirl, my mind whirls so badly, you know, with fear. And I've heard a lot of y'all talk about that, and I want to share this little thing with you about fear. I was always so afraid that something would happen to some of my family. And if it did, some of my kids would be out there drunk. And I would have to go find them and try to shape them up. And I knew good and well if I could find them, they'd look like terrible. And I'd have to go buy them some new clothes and get them lined up so we'd go to the funeral and look good. Like I always wanted us to look. And so I came home from a meeting on 18th day of May in 1993. And my little old husband was standing outside the door of my house. And he said, "Let's hurry, June. Your daddy's had a heart attack." When we got to St. Francis Hospital, my little daughter Regina met me at the door one more time. And she put her arms around me and she told me he was gone. And we were able to step to the telephone and call her brother, who was down in Fort Smith, and he was able to come home. Mike, thank the Lord, was on a sober spell along about then. Called him in Dallas. He was on a plane and he was home next day. I didn't have to take one of those kids to town, dress them up. They all showed up looking their very Sunday best, and they carried their granddaddy in honor and dignity to his grave. And they walked beside that little grandmama that had been so instrumental in their raising, in dignity and honor, because of this program. And you wonder, sometimes people wonder why I have so much gratitude for this program. It saved a family. Put us back together. I read often in my little ODAP book here, my very favorite thing. It says, "He has delivered my soul in peace from the battles that were against me, and there were many with me." And that's on the 29th day of February in this book. And I think of that, and I think that over 2,000 years ago, a man stood on a mountaintop, and he gave out a way of life to a group of people. And many years later, the miracle of it all was that Bill Wilson sobered up long enough to hear the message and write it down in the form of the 12 steps. And he took those 12 steps, which I believe are divinely inspired, and he passed them along to a group of people, the families of the alcoholics who needed it so badly. And because of that, I am here, and my family is all right. So I like to close my story by telling you all, we always showed horses. You know, we showed cutting horses, and I don't know if y'all know what that is or not, but my job was to be the turnback help. Turnback help sets out in front of the man that's cutting and takes the verbal abuse if you're his wife. And I got sick and tired of that, and I decided that I wanted to learn to ride a cutting horse. And so my husband bought me a mare, a little mare, and I had the boots and the chaps, hats, spurs, whole nine yards. And he sent me off to an old master that lived over at Tecumseh, Oklahoma, a man named Pat Patterson, who had won many world championship awards. And he sent me over there to him. I stayed with him a couple of weeks, and then I went off to another place and stayed a couple of weeks. And I practiced, and I fell off, and I got back up, and I got back on, and kept trying and trying and trying to do it right. And the day finally arrived that it was time for me to go show my horse. And I was never, ever so scared in all my life. And when I got to the cutting, Mr. Pat, who had been my teacher, showed up to help me. And so when you go to a cutting, you know, you ride in the herd, cut that cow out. There are two men that sit out here. That's your turnback help. And there's a man that sits on either side of you. That's the herd holders. They keep those cattle from running in that corner. And if you listen, they talk to you. And they tell you which cow to cut and what to do and what to do, because they can see it easier than you. And so that day, my husband and Mr. Pat took me aside And they said to me, my husband said to me, now, June, just relax. You're all right. Just relax. You go in there and sit way down deep in that saddle. Get down on your pockets. You relax. Give that mare her head. And trust her. She knows what to do. Just trust her. You just relax and trust her. I had the best. Just go in there and trust that mare, and you'll be fine. And I thought about that one day, and I related that to what my God says to me on a daily basis. And he says to me, June, I have sent you to the masters. You have the very best set of tools known to man. All you have to do is just get up, go in there, relax. Let me alone and let me do my work. Trust me and listen for my voice, and I'll talk you through it. And he talks me through it every single day. And he'll talk you through it too if you'll just let him. God bless you, each and every one, and thank you.